Let's go back to that question of, are we trading surveillance from companies to governments? Because you definitely could have countries that could take advantage of this. Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with Dr. Paul Ashley. Paul, how are you today?
I'm very good. And thanks for having a conversation today. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. It really helps me out. Thanks in advance. Paul, tell us about your background and how you get to where you are today.
I've got a bit of a long history in kind of the identity space. So if I go back really to the late 90s, I did a PhD in network security and authorization. And that was my start into identity, because it was about how do you authorize access for users to different systems. I then went into IBM for 15 years, both in the US and in Australia, working across a whole bunch of identity and security and privacy products. And then in 2014, which is really a very privacy focused company, like we're really trying to help end users with their privacy. So that's really my last, 25 years or so.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, tell me a little bit more about Anonymy.
Okay, so Anonymy, as I said, I left IBM back in 2014 and helped start Anonymy. And right from the beginning, what we wanted to do is provide end users more privacy and security and safety online. Back in 2014, we knew that people's privacy was really being impacted. And what we've seen over the last 10 years, that it's got a lot worse. When we started, what we said is, look, we want to build some tools for users. So when they're online, we don't want them all going and living in the cabin in the woods. We need to be online, and life is online now, so we need to be there. How do they get more secure? And this is where one of the ideas that came out of enterprise security, which is the idea of proxies. And so where we started, we said is, well, maybe when you go online, maybe you don't go into all your personal details, like your mobile phone number and your personal email address. Why don't you create a set of proxies for yourself? And we call these proxy pseudos or personas. And so what we did is we started out with some mobile apps that allow people to create these personas to go online with the idea that they're kind of swapping their identity attributes. So when I go to an online shop, rather than giving my mobile phone number, how about I give an alternate phone number for that persona? Instead of giving my personal email address, how about I give a persona email address? Why don't I use a virtual credit card rather than the plastic credit card in my wallet? And you don't just have one persona. Like, I personally have about 9 personas, but you have these different personas that you use at different parts of your life. And what you're really doing is trying to interrupt that surveillance and the ease at which they can follow you around the internet and do all the things that you're doing. So that's, Jake, is where we started the company. And obviously we've progressed a lot from that, working with enterprises, doing a lot of other technologies. But this is where we started. The foundation was, I want users to be able to go online and be more safe and private and secure.
Now, you alluded to this, the reason behind Anonymy. Can you talk to us about that whole concept of surveillance and surveillance?
Yeah, and people use different terms. People use, the surveillance economy or surveillance capitalism. And the first things that come to mind is companies like Google and Meta and these big companies, right? And what we've seen over the last 10 years is this increased concentration. So we've seen these big players like the Googles, the Meta, LinkedIn, Twitter. Yeah, we could probably name 6 to 10 of these large organizations. And there's this centralization of everything. So what's that's enabling those companies to do is to be able to track all the things that you do. And if you think about, let's take Google as an example, they give you some really excellent tools, like Gmail's excellent, Google Maps is excellent. Like, you could go down the whole list. They're all really well built, well designed that. And they give them away for free. But why do they give them for free? Because they want to understand your interactions or your digital trail. They want to know the things that you're interested in, what sports you're interested in, what's your politics like, who are you communicating with, what services are you using. The best way to do that is to help by giving you lots of tools to use while you're online. And it gives them a great ability to surveil you, essentially just provide surveillance. And then you say, why do they do that? Well, it comes down to their business model. If you go to something like Google, something like 95% of their revenue is from advertising. So it's really selling the ability that they know you to advertisers so they can target you specifically. And they do a really good job of it. And they get paid a lot of money to do that because they really do know what everybody's doing and what their thoughts are and all that. So that's the world that we're living in. So I think even from 2014 to now, that problem's got worse. And so more and more people need to be thinking about their privacy and ways of protecting their own privacy. If you don't mind, I might even give you a bit more of a history lesson of identity. So if we go on the internet, right, if you go back to the 90s, and that's really when I started in this business in the identity space, is we had what we call on the internet a centralized enterprise model. And what that meant is every time you went and created an account on a service, you would go and give them a username, password. You'd give them a bunch of personal detail and maybe set up second factor. But it was kind of a one-to-one relationship. You wanted to use Uber, I created an account on Uber. I want to use Twitter, I created an account on Twitter. That was the model in the 90s into the 2000s. And we know the difficulties of that. One is that why do we have password managers? Because we all have 100, 200, 300 accounts that fit that model. Each one of those accounts have a personal data with us. We're trying to manage passwords. We're trying to manage two factors. It's a very bad environment. And what happens in any of those accounts out there, your personal data is either stolen, and we see that every week on the news. We see, okay, there's another breach somewhere, or they actually just sell your data without your permission, right? So that's the problem with a centralized model. And then in the 2000s, we start to see a new model called the federated model, right? People call it social login. People are familiar with login with Google, login with Facebook, login with Twitter, login with LinkedIn, any of those social logins. What's actually happening there is you're saying, oh, I don't need to create an account on this new service. What I do is I just might use my Google account. I'll go there and log in. They'll create a token and then that'll let me access. From a convenience point of view for the user, you think, oh, that's great. I don't need all these extra passwords and things. But from a privacy point of view, you've just made the system much worse for yourself, because all of a sudden these big players, as I said, these big centralized players have now got a great way of knowing all the services that you're a part of. And behind the scenes, that identity provider like Google and that service provider like Uber can just pass personal information about you. So the privacy problems can be made even worse, right? So this is where we got to about, I would say, around about the middle of the 2000s and say 2010, 2015. And then we can start to talk about what I think is the new model that's coming that's going to be really replacing those two previous models.
Okay. So just to sum it up, a centralized model is where you go to whatever website, you set up a username and account there, go to another website, set up a separate username and password there. And then the federated, of course, we're all familiar with all those login social buttons. And I actually never thought about it from a privacy standpoint before I heard you say it. And when you click on it, typically it'll say, do you want to give them access to this amount of information in your profile? It's also interesting to think about that access remains, from what I understand. It isn't a one-time thing. It just stays there.
What you've effectively done is you've established a relationship on your behalf between that identity provider like Google and that service provider like Uber. You've kind of given permission for them to establish a relationship on your behalf. So there's no reason why they can't exchange more information behind the scenes. You know, the identity provider can provide the service provider more information and vice versa, right? Because you've established that relationship for them.
Well, that's fascinating. What is this new model that you referred to?
Probably going back about 5 years, 7 years, there was this new terminology and people called it self-sovereign identity. We also heard the term decentralized identity. Other people talked about verifiable credentials. Other people use the term digital identity or digital credentials. And so there was this new technology that was kind of founded maybe 7 years ago now. What it really is, decentralized identity, it's changing the model from centralized and federated to what they call a decentralized model. And the foundation of that is you have a wallet in your mobile device, for example, you have an identity wallet. In that identity wallet, you hold all your identities, you hold your cryptographic keys, you hold things like verifiable credentials. And verifiable credentials could be a driver's license or a passport or whatever the electronic credential is that you've got in there. And the idea is instead of going to a site and creating a new username password, you just connect to that site from your wallet. It's kind of a peer relationship. And then when you exchange information, you present from your credentials to them. They may issue new credentials to you. The idea is that you have a lot more control of the data that's going between you and that entity. So for example, they say, present your driver's license. You say, well, I don't really want to present my driver's license because then you'll know my home address and my birth date, and you'll know all these things. What you really want to know is some piece of that information. So I'm just going to present that to you. One of the ideas of decentralized identity is to minimize the amount of personal information that goes from you to that service, and you're in control at all times. So it is a new paradigm, and it's starting to get a lot of momentum around the world. So before long, your users are going to go, what's this mobile wallet? How come I've got a Californian driver's license electronic wallet? And I can talk a lot more about what sort of things are happening in Europe and what's happening in the US and other places around the world.
Yeah, tell us. I'd love to hear it.
Okay, let's take Europe, for example. And I think Europe has probably become, over the last year or so, the most advanced in this area. So they've actually got this legislation called EIDAS, and it's spelled EIDAS. And that legislation is about digital identities across Europe. The interesting thing about that legislation is it's all about decentralized approach. It's not about a centralized approach, it's a decentralized approach, right? And it's about decentralized identity. So I'll tell you what the expectation is, and there's another document called the EU Digital Identity Wallet, and this another one called the Architecture Reference Framework that describes what that wallet needs to do. But the expectation in Europe is that every country must produce for their citizens this digital identity wallet following these standards. And you can imagine with it, by 2026, every resident and citizen within the European Union has this identity wallet. In that identity wallet, they're also expected to issue at least one credential, being their national identity credential. So if you're in Germany, you get this credential, says, okay, you're a resident or a citizen of Germany. And that's kind of the minimum. So what they're saying by 2026 is all 450 million residents and citizens within the EU will have a wallet and they'll have at least one credential in there. But at the same time, they're doing all these large scale projects across driver's license, across travel, across healthcare, across farming, across mining, that looks at other ways of using this digital wallet to do those sort of use cases. So they really are pushing it in a big way. And that's the European case. And I would say it's really marching forward quickly. Even in the US, it's going slightly in a different fashion, but it's also moving very quickly. By the end of this year, by the end of 2024, 20 out of the 50 states of the US will have digital driver's licenses. The standard's called MDL. It's an ISO standard. If you have a look already, if you go to California, you can get an identity wallet issued by them into your mobile device, and you can get this mobile driver's license. And now they're looking at a whole lot of use cases about how to use that. So you can imagine in the US, 20 of the states will have that by the end of the year. I would say another year or two, all of the states will have it. And it is a certain standard called mobile driver's license, ISO standard. And so it means they're all interoperable. And it's also interoperable with Europe, because Europe is also mandating that MDL standard. So what you're seeing is this real groundswell of use of this concept that we'll all have digital identity wallets, we'll have multiple identities in there, and we'll have lots of these different credentials. So that's kind of where we are at the moment. And it's kind of interesting. I can talk lots more details about the technology and other cases, but I guess what we're doing is I'm laying the foundation to say, this is what everyone's going to be seeing. Whether you like it or not, in the next year or two, you will have a digital identity wallet and you will have credentials in that wallet.
Wow. Well, before we spoke, I just had no idea all this was going on. That's really something. Tell us more about the verifiable credentials.
Yeah. So you'll say, I don't like the sound of that, like a digital driver's license. Well, in fact, it is a big step up for both security and privacy. Let's just take an example of that, you know, the MDL, the mobile driver's license. So when I go to the US, you know, I go to Salt Lake City, we have an office there, and I often go in the evening out to a restaurant or a bar. And the first thing they do is they ask for my driver's license or my passport. And it's pretty uncomfortable because you're handing over this document that has things like, if you hand over my driver's license, it not only has my photo and my name and my birthday, but it also has my home address and it says what sort of vehicles I can drive and that I have to wear glasses and all these things, right? And I'm like, you guys don't need that, especially you don't need to know my home address. All you're trying to do is prove to yourself that I'm over 21. But if you look at the driver's license version of that, so you turn up this time with your electronic driver's license and you present it to them. But what you can say is you can have my photo and maybe my birthday. It's what they call selective disclosure. And so the verifiable credential allows the user to then say, here's my photo and here's my birthday. That's all you know. You don't even need to know my name. You don't need to know my home address. You don't need all of that. This is all you're getting. That's one advantage of verifiable credentials, is selective disclosure. Another area where you go a bit deeper is zero knowledge proof. So in this case, what you say is, I'm going to give you my photo and I'm going to prove cryptographically that I'm over 21, but you're not even going to get my birth date. What we're doing here is we're raising the bar on privacy. I've now gone to the bar. The bar has it confirmed electronically that I'm over 21, but all they know is I've got a photo and this guy's over 21. They've proven that. They don't have all that other personal information, which what they do, they store on their system, and what happens, you know, it's going to get stolen, sold or whatever. So you're giving away a lot less personal information. It also has the other advantages if, for example, that credential needs to be revoked. So let's say, you know, I do drink driving, they need to revoke my license. The issuer can revoke it. And when the verifier goes to verify, it'll say, oh, this credential's been revoked. Again, that's not something you can do with a plastic driver's license. These are the benefits of an electronic verifiable credential versus, say, a plastic one. And you say, how do they do all this? Well, it's just cryptography, right? So they created a document, they sign, the issuer signs it. When the holder, which that's the person with the wallet, presents it, they do what they call a presentation proof. proof, and they're signing information that can be verified. So, you know, the verifier at that bar knows who the issue was. It was a California DMV. They know that it hasn't been altered. They know it hasn't been revoked and all those good things. So there's a lot of really good characteristics about this. I actually look at it in a positive way.
Talk to us more about the standards and protocols that are used with these wallets.
There is a lot of work happening. And where all this design, you say, where's all this work happening? It's all happening in the standards groups. So there's a whole bunch of standards groups like ISO, the standards body that does the mobile driver's license. There's an IETF, which does this credential format. W3C, which does a credential format and the DID identifier format. And so across about five or six of these standards bodies, all the decentralized identity work is happening. That's where they're designing things like the signature types and the protocols and all those kind of things. But let me talk about the different standards. The first is the credential format. So the format of that credential that's stored in your wallet, what is that? Well, there's multiple different credential formats. There's one called anonymous credentials, which is really used in use cases where you really want anonymity. There's another format called W3C credential, which is probably the most popular, and that comes out of the W3C working group. There's the MDL credential, which again is a different format, which is from the one I talked about, the ISO format. And then we're even seeing new ones. IETF has a new one called SDJWT. So that's just the credentials. There's the next layer is the credential exchange protocols. How do I get from the issuer, say the California DMV, into my wallet? How do I present that to a bar? Like, what are those protocols? They're called credential exchange protocols. And again, there's what we call the DIDCOM ARIES protocols. There's the OpenID for VC. Even the MDL, the mobile driver's license, had their own protocols. So you're seeing multiple protocols. And then underlying all this is you've got what they call the verifiable data registry, which is often a blockchain or a ledger. And what happens there is it provides the trust for the system. And so when you're actually building a system, you may have to say, I'm going to support a Hyperledger Indy, or I'm going to support the Check Network, or this verifiable data registry is going to be Ethereum or Bitcoin. So there's different things you can do there. So think of it like we're a software vendor that builds products. So we build wallets and we have a personal wallet and an enterprise wallet and all that. We've got to implement all of these protocols and support these different verifiable data registries so that we can work in all sorts of different use cases. So it's a challenge for any software provider in this industry to be able to support these different protocols and standards. Yeah.
Hey everyone, Jacob here. Let me tell you about today's sponsor, Vanta. As the number and severity of third-party breaches continues to rise, companies are increasingly vigilant, not just about how they handle their own data, but how their vendors do as well. For compliance leaders, this means more security reviews are coming across your desk every day, and valuable time is being wasted on manual security reviews. With Vanta questionnaire automation, compliance teams can complete security reviews up to 5 times faster, giving you time back to focus on running your compliance programs. Over 8,000 global companies like ZoomInfo, Smart Recruiters, and Noibu use Vanta to save time on security reviews. Experience questionnaire automation with a self-guided product tour, no signup required, at vanta.com/grcacademy. That's vanta.com/grcacademy. Thanks and enjoy the rest of the episode.
One thing I'd love to talk about is wallets, though. One of the questions I get a lot is, isn't the wallet a source of surveillance, right? You know, the California DMV gives you a wallet and you start to use it for your driver's license and put a whole bunch of other credentials in there, couldn't that be a point of surveillance? And the answer is, of course, yes. My feeling is that if you were to get something like the California Identity Wallet and use that, or there's lots of private ones out there, lots of different companies have got them as well, I think they're pretty safe because if they try to surveil from those apps, it will take 5 minutes for people to realize that. And you know, they'll have a lot of kind of bad press about that.
Let's go back to that question of, are we trading surveillance from companies to governments? Because you definitely could have countries that could take advantage of this. And like you said, these apps that come out, they will be heavily scrutinized. And if it's beaming back to whatever server widget you're using, I'm sure that will be quickly found out.
So fundamentally, I feel like it's a good solution. And the reason I think it's a good solution is that it is a decentralized solution. A centralized solution, and we are seeing those in certain countries, is where everything's going through, like you log in there, you get authenticated, and you can use it to access all sorts of service. That's very much a centralized model. And the real issue I have with that is just prone to abuse, whether it's the government surveilling you or that the government finally get that information stolen and all that kind of thing. So the centralized model, which you'll see some countries doing, I find isn't very palatable. I think this is a better model being decentralized. They call it portable trust. So I go to the Californian DMV, I get this credential, I can then present it. Now, when I'm presenting it, the California DMV, right, it's separated. I'm kind of carrying the trust with me and I'm using it and I can use it in all sorts of places and there's no kind of overall surveillance of that. And same with all the other credentials that you have. So the actual model, I think, is very strong versus a centralized model, but we still, as we have to be cautious, like we have to say, what's this wallet doing? You know, how are they interacting? And even when you're being involved, so that, you know, you're online and you're buying some alcohol online, they say, I've got to prove again you're over 21. So you go, I'll present my driver's license. The user really needs to watch what question they ask because the site will say, present your driver's license. And again, they could say, present your photo and your birthday, or they could just say, present the whole thing. So it's still up to the user to have some awareness of what they're presenting to each of these online sites. One thing that is happening as well is that Apple and Google, we're all used to using like Apple wallets and Google wallets on our phone. And traditionally, we've just used them for pretty simple things like, here's my boarding pass and I can show it when I'm going through to get onto a plane. But they're also now enabling their wallets for decentralized identity and verifiable credentials. So already the Apple wallet and Google wallet, only just in the last few months, they've proved interoperability between Apple and Google, is that they now support that mobile driver's license. So instead of using the California app, why don't I just put it into my Apple wallet or my Google wallet? That's when I sort of start to get a bit more nervous, because if you start to use the Apple wallet for all of your credentials across travel and healthcare, driving, and whatever else you're doing, right, you've probably given them a pretty good point of surveillance of you. So I'm more nervous about sort of the Apple wallet and Google wallet versus sort of a private wallet or even a government wallet.
In the crypto world, you hear about cold storage wallets. Is there anything like that that's totally disconnected, yet you can still scan it or whatever?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So first thing I'll talk about is what they call hardware security modules. So one of the requirements of the EU wallet is that you use a hardware security module on your mobile device. So if you go to an iOS device, you've got an iPhone or an iPad or whatever, or a Google, and mainly the higher end devices like the Pixels or the Samsungs, et cetera, they all have these really good secure enclaves in them, right? And what the secure enclave means is I can create like a cryptographic key pair, a private public key pair within the enclave. I can export the public key, but I can do all my cryptographic operations within the secure enclave. The idea there is there's no way that somebody can steal your wallet and then go and impersonate you because they can't get the keys out of the secure enclave. So I think that's really important. But they also have this requirement that you have to be able to use them offline. So if you're in a situation where there's no network connectivity, you've also got to be able to use your wallet. So these are all part of the requirements and we'll see it. Most of the wallets that I've seen now are more around being able to work when they're online, but there is that offline case as well.
How do you think identity theft will evolve with solutions like this?
Well, I actually think it's a great defense against identity theft. I think what happens at the moment is people are out there and they just collect information about you. If they want to steal your identity, what they need to do is find as much about you as they can. And a lot of that's online. And then they can sort of turn up and say, yeah, I'm Jake. And I can kind of prove I'm Jake when I'm not really Jake. Right? That's kind of the identity theft. I think with these wallets, especially with a hardware security module, the difference is you could turn up and go, let me present my driver's license to you and prove that I'm Jake. And guess what? You really are Jake, because that cannot be stolen from your wallet, especially if you're using a hardware security module. So I think there's actually a natural defense against identity theft with this, because all you've got to do is be asked to present some of your credentials from your wallet. And if you're using a hardware security module, it means that people can't even copy that. The attack becomes really difficult. It means they've got to really take over or steal your phone to be able to pretend to be you, which is a pretty hard attack, really.
It makes me smile. My DoD friends will laugh with me. There's this annual security awareness training that we've taken over the years, and it's kind of outdated. And so there's this guy in the coffee shop, and he's like, hey, can I use your smartphone? You know?
Exactly.
And, you know, of course, the right answer is no. But I mean, if your identity is on this device, that's correct. A whole nother issue.
It is. But I think it's still a good thing, because the attack surface is very small. They've got to get to you. They've got to get to your phone and start to do things on behalf of you. It's a very difficult attack versus I just need to do, you know, a search of Jake and get enough information I can prove to someone who I want to get a loan with that I'm really Jake. You know, it's like it's a totally different thing.
You mentioned your privacy apps before, the MySudo app. Can you tell us a bit more about the enterprise offering?
If you look at the anonymous history, we started with these B2C, which is these just mobile apps. We said, everybody's got mobile phones. Let's give them apps. And that's where we came up with MySudo, where you create model personas, and each persona, you can spin up a phone number and an email address, and you got a sort of separate browser and virtual cards and all those things. And that's where we started. The reason we got into enterprise, which was around about 2017, is enterprises came to us and said, look, we've seen MySudo and these privacy and security capabilities. What if we were to provide these in our own app to our own users? And so we actually then built what we call the platform. We call it the Sudo platform or the Anonymy platform, which is a whole stack of different security and privacy services that you can kind of mix and match into an application. And so sometimes we're building a desktop application, sometimes a mobile application, sometimes it's a browser extension to go on a browser. So we do all these things. And because we provide all these different security and privacy services, somebody can come along and go, I want an app. I want to help people do shopping. I think I need them to have a phone number, an email address, a virtual credit card in a safe browser. And I want to put that in app for my users. So that's how we got into the enterprise offering. And then how do we get into decentralized identity? Again, the way it crossed our path is it was always built to be very security and privacy focused. And we said, well, that's probably something we need to know about because we need to provide that technology to our end users or through enterprises to their end users. And that's how we got into the decentralized identity space. Kind of follow that same, you know, kind of logical progression.
Well, this has been awesome. I've really learned quite a bit talking with you. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. Where can people find you?
I think the best thing to do is just look on the Anonymy website. If you ever look on the Anonymy website, you know, we've got stacks of white papers and blog articles that talk all about that. We're a digital identity company. If they really want to think about privacy, you start like with the MySudo app and actually install it and try to understand what it means to have multiple personas, because privacy is a journey. You probably need to spend 6 months, 12 months changing the way you approach online activities to get more and more private over time. Are you using, a VPN? Do you have a password manager? Do you have multiple personas so that you don't have to take your personal phone number, personal email address, and personal credit card out to the web? All those sort of things. So it is a journey. So I would suggest people go in it. And the easiest way is just install MySudo, start playing with it, create some personas, and start to understand that concepts of what it means to be private online.
Excellent. I'll put all those links in the description below. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.